Every school invited to the NCAA basketball tournament has had a chance to play. So we thought we'd bring you details of every game. Well, maybe not details, but at least a mention from NPR's Mike Pesca. And what he lacks in specifics, he makes up for in rhyme.
New Mexico beat Long Beach State by a final of 75-68. So Albuquerque's partying, but not so in Las Cruces, because New Mexico State lost their game to the Indiana Hoosiers. VCU and Kansas State both had thrilling wins, as did Florida State and the St. Louis Billikens. Coach Majerus has been in 12 tournaments, won a game in almost all. Skill, right? No. Quote,
"So it's sometimes the bounce of the ball."
So humble, that Majerus, one of the game's great self-effacers. He's 1-0, just like Marquette and the Murray Racers. Baylor outshined the Jackrabbits of South Dakota State. Purdue and Colorado built big leads and held on late. When the sprightly coach of Cincinnati said his players
just refused to lose,
some might think the referees had the same attitude towards Syracuse. Georgetown beat up on Belmont, Wisconsin surmounted Montana, Louisville in Florida took a step towards the Final Four in Louisiana. Against top seed Carolina, Vermont was not so lucky, and it looks like the NBA draft is the only thing that could put a dent in Kentucky. There, Anthony Davis says a key is
for our shooters to knock down shots and spread the game out.
In other news, a lane violation helped Xavier knock Notre Dame out. Iowa State dispatched with the defending champ UConn. Cyclone coach Fred Hoiberg factually noted,
"I thought it was fun."
13-seed Ohio faced down Michigan without fear. Coach Gross went on to note,
"Well, we're playing our best basketball of the year."
The Bobcat coach is talking truth. He's not much of a bragger. Take your win in stride and play with pride, like NC State and Gonzaga. And now that Lehigh's won, how does your office pool look? From the little town of Bethlehem, the Mountain Hawks soared past Mighty Duke. Another 2-seed, Norfolk State, wreaked chaos on many a bracket. Guard Chris McEachin noted that
the whole gym was ecstatic.
But for little LIU, the Spartans' Draymond Green proved too much.
Day-day with another payday, and Michigan State finds a way whenever he gets a touch.
Oh, look who's rhyming now. CBS, you're really reaching new lows. Like Charles Barkley's commentary, you should just stick to the pros. 16 more games this weekend means hoops as far as the eye can see. Mike Pesca, NPR News, Nashville, Tennessee.
Basketball is my favorite sport. I like the way they dribble up and down the court. Just like I'm the king on the microphone. So is Dr. J and Moses Malone. I like slam dunks and taking it to the hoop. My favorite play is the alley-oop. I like the pick and roll. I like the give and go. Cause it's basketball, but Mr. Curtis Blow.
This is NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Jackie Lydon. Checking on your retirement and mutual fund statements is getting a bit less scary. The stock market cleared another hurdle this week, with the S&P 500 closing above 1,400 for the first time in almost 4 years. And the Dow Jones Industrials are up almost 25% from their recent low back in early October. NPR's John Itzty is here to tell us what's driving the market. John, thank you for coming in.
You're welcome, Jackie.
So some interesting numbers, and unemployment is still high, gas prices higher, deficits still extraordinarily large. Why are investors pushing stocks higher?
The economy still faces some big challenges, but there were a number of things this week that provided some optimism. For instance, on Tuesday, Federal Reserve officials offered a somewhat brighter view of the economy in the statement that they issued following their regular meeting. They used phrases like, "the economy has been expanding moderately," and "the labor market has improved," and "strains on global financial markets have eased," a reference to some lessening of the European debt crisis. The Fed officials were still guarded, not popping champagne corks, but investors responded very positively.
There was another thing that was interesting this week. The Fed issued another report card on some of the nation's biggest banks. And what did that tell us about the health of the economy?
Well, it certainly suggested that the financial sector, which has been at the center of our economic problems, is healing. The Fed put the nation's 19 largest banks through another stress test to find out how many could continue to lend if the economy really tanked again. It found all but one of them had enough capital to absorb losses and continue operating. And passing the test means many of these banks were taken off the short regulatory leash they've been on And that means they can boost dividend payments to shareholders and buy back stock. And this made investors much more interested in owning bank shares, and that helped boost the market.
But gasoline prices continued to rise this week, and surely that is a drag on the economy.
Yes, they did rise. They're up about 20% since mid-December and closing in on $4 a gallon on average for regular. And it is a negative for the economy. It has hurt consumer sentiment. On the other hand, a report earlier this week shows retail sales rising and consumers continuing to spend. And remember, the unemployment rate is down. We've had the best 3 months of job creation in a couple of years, and consumers are spending less to heat their homes because of the warm winter. So all that is helping to support confidence.
You know, with that sort of good news, is it too soon to say that a recovery is finally here?
Well, we're in a recovery. It's very slow. And remember, both last year and the year before, we started strong and then faded. There are still threats to this recovery, from rising oil prices, a potential confrontation with Iran, another flare-up in the European debt crisis, a slowdown in China. So there's plenty to worry about, though it does feel a little different right now.
John, there's one other story we noted in the news this week that we wanted to ask you about, and that is the story of a Goldman Sachs vice president named Greg Smith, who resigned publicly from the investment bank in the op-ed pages of the New York Times. And he slammed the bank for what he said was a toxic culture at the firm and a disdainful attitude toward clients. Given the doubts that have already been raised around companies like Goldman Sachs, what impact do you think that's going to have on Americans' attitudes about Wall Street?
Well, it certainly doesn't help. In his letter, Smith says that Goldman employees denigrated clients, calling them Muppets, and tried to sell them products aimed at only maximizing profits for Goldman Sachs. We've heard similar stories before. You'll remember congressional hearings after the financial crisis, where Goldman executives were condemned for selling financial products to clients and then betting against them. Smith's letter got a lot of attention, and things like this may be one of the reasons that small investors continue to be distrustful and have not really jumped back into the market.
Well, NPR's John Itzie, thank you very much for being with us today.
You're welcome, Jackie.
Two pairs of filmmaking brothers happen to have movies opening on the same weekend. Jeff, who lives at home, is a comedy by the Duplass brothers. The Kid with a Bike is a Belgian slice-of-life drama from the Dardenne brothers. Critic Bob Mandela says the two films are different in tone, but are essentially about the same thing, the awkwardness of growing up.
The Kid with a Bike begins with a kid without a bike, 11-year-old Cyril, abandoned in foster care by a dad who left no forwarding address. Cyril figures his father must have cared enough to at least keep his bicycle safe for him, so he returns to their now-empty apartment, and when the authorities come to take him back, he tackles a random bystander, Samantha, and clings to her, wailing that he wants his dad and his bike. Samantha, struck by this desperate little boy, finds out who his dad sold the bike to and buys it back. And when Cyril asks, she even lets him stay with her on weekends. Why? Well, an American filmmaker would feel obligated to give her an explanatory backstory, but the Dardenne brothers tend not to explain much in their eloquently unforced pictures. They just let her help this kid, which is not an easy task. Cyril's a wild child, furious at the world, convinced against all evidence that his father still cares, and when dad disappoints, looking for father figures in terrible places. If you've seen other Dardenne brother films, the one, say, where a drifter sells his girlfriend's infant on the black market, it will worry you when Cyril falls in with a neighborhood tough. Kid with a Bike may find its writer-director siblings in what is for them an almost sunny frame of mind, but that's hardly the end of Cyril's tough ride through childhood. The Duplass brothers traffic in more whimsical down-to-earthiness, shambling, squirmy, low-budget comedies about the awkward situations that real people find themselves in. Jeff, for instance, the 30-something slacker who still, as the title indicates, lives at home, much to his mother's annoyance.
Hello?
Mom?
Jeff?
Hi.
You know you're supposed to say hello when you pick up the phone.
Yeah, I know. I thought that maybe you were somebody else, but you're not.
What do you do in the basement? You're not cleaning it.
You really want to know? You didn't like it last time we had this
conversation. Okay, no, you're right. I don't. Did you get the
Jeff's played by Jason Segel. Susan Sarandon is his mom, and Ed Helms, his annoying older sibling. A big-name cast for the Duplass brothers. Their rep comes from flicks so scruffy they're labeled mumblecore. But in Jeff Who Lives at Home, they use that same low-rent vibe to get at a kid's need for family and love, much as Kid with a Bike does.
I've been having this really weird dream about Dad lately. He says, Pat, what's the greatest day in the history of the world? And I'm like, Dad, I don't know. And he just looks at me and he smiles.
He says today.
How'd you know that?
Brothers just know, right? Which may be why these two pairs of filmmaking brothers, Mark and Jay Duplass and Jean-Pierre and Luc Dardenne, can bring such warmth to tales of loners. An 11-year-old looking for his bike and a man-child looking for direction. I'm Bob Mondello.
In The Law of Dreams, Canadian writer Peter Behrens' first novel, an Irish immigrant makes his way out of famine-starved Ireland to Canada. The novel came out in 2006 to wide acclaim. Now Behrens has followed up with another multi-generational novel. The O'Briens opens in 1867 with teenage Joe O'Brien scratching out a living in Quebec after his father and mother have died. Joe will go on to become the novel's patriarch. Behrens has taken the story of Canada's nation-building, its railroads, towns, churches, and along with two world wars, made it part of the epic sweep of this book, which spans the decades to end in the 1960s. Peter Behrens joins us now from Marfa Public Radio in Marfa, Texas. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Jackie.
So I've given a bit of an introduction to your protagonist, Joe O'Brien. Would you give us a picture of this very resourceful young man?
Joe is a tough guy who comes out of the bush, as we see in Canada, the real backwoods in the 1890s, and as a poor boy and an orphan, and makes himself a fortune and a family by building railways in Western Canada in the period of just before the First World War. Has a big family and wrestles with a lot of ghosts and demons from the Irish past.
You're obviously drawn to the Irish experience in North America. Tell me a little bit about your fascination and your own heritage.
Yeah, my great-great-grandfather, of whom I actually know very little other than that he came out of County Clare in the worst of the famine summers, 1847, and crawled ashore that summer on the wharf at Windmill Point in Montreal. At the same time, my family in Montreal were, you know, prosperous people, and they weren't necessarily interested in being Irish by the time I got there. Ireland was, you know, in the dim past and forgotten largely, and the memories connected to it were those of, you know, sort of shame and poverty. They were very determined to be Canadian and be successful, and they were.
And that's kind of where you start this book, isn't it? I mean, Joe O'Brien isn't particularly riffing on his Irish past, but he really wants to be the new man in the new place.
Yeah, Joe is largely based on my grandfather and my granddaddy. His name was John Joseph O'Brien. He had four daughters, Mary Margaret, Mary Frances, Mary Patricia, and Mary Althea. He was the first warden of the Ascension of Our Lord Parish in Montreal, and yet somehow we weren't Irish. We were Canadian. You know, we were in the present, in the now, and all that Ireland stuff had been something that had happened in the dim past, and we were over it.
So I want to stay with the character of Joe, where at first he seems like he's just going to be all industry. He develops a dark habit. He has a lost night after the death of one of his children. He gets stone drunk. It seems like maybe it's just going to be a one-off, but this becomes a pattern.
Yeah, and I think it's the consequence of what we were speaking of earlier, all the stuff in this guy's past, his family past, the Irish past that he's not interested in exploring or expressing. That darkness and silence comes, and that lack of finally of feeling at home anywhere in the world, which comes from not acknowledging, you know, who you really are and where you come from, all that gets expressed in his relationship to the bottle. He manages to hold it together 364 days a year, maybe even for a couple of years, and then he takes himself off to New York, takes a tower suite in the Pierre, and, you know, he's found 2 days later in a pile of whiskey bottles on the floor.
You take them into combat in World War II, and you might almost have done a separate novel based around this because it's so gritty and the voice changes and the novel becomes quite epistolary here.
I felt the sense that these boys being overseas in the 40s, cracked them open in certain ways, and the experience of combat opened and closed them in certain ways. And a lot of things that they didn't really have the language to express, given their kind of provincial bourgeois upbringing in Montreal, were fighting for language in these letters. They're fighting to try to figure out how to explain to these women back at home what they've been through. And in a way, there really is no language in their culture for it.
Why don't we read a letter? How about Sicily, August 1943?
This is a letter from Joe's son-in-law, who's married his oldest daughter, Margot, and he's gone overseas with a French-Canadian regiment, and he's fighting in Sicily in the summer of 1943, and he's writing back to his wife in Montreal, who is, you know, a pretty innocent provincial girl. Margot, ma chère, my pen is almost dry as my mouth. What clothes do you wear, Margot? Do your fingers touch this paper? Does the ink speak to you? How are we connected exactly, Margot? I feel more of a connection to certain bullets than to you. Let me dispose of my adjectives. In your arms, please let me release them. Bloody, silly, fecal, loud, beaten, red, terror. You see, I have slipped into nouns, so let me deliver a few more, Margot. You don't have to unwrap these. Just sign for them. Then you can put them away. Machine gun, anti-tank, 303, 88, tree burst, counterattack, head wound, neck wound, prisoner, aorta, femoral artery, battle. Are your thighs still your thighs? Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize.
You're a good reader.
Thank you.
What is it about the multi-generational family epic that so interests you? This is the second time you've done it now, and I was thinking, well, does he turn into the Kennedys? But I guess you had so much material in your own family. Perhaps not.
Well, you know, I feel lucky. I grew up in a family that early on fascinated me. I mean, we were 17 cousins. We all grew up within a mile and a half radius of my grandfather's house on the mountain in Montreal. When I was a boy, they seemed very glamorous and romantic and almost mythic to me. And that fascination sort of at a certain point, you know, went numb, and I wanted to get away from there and get out of there and become Jack Kerouac and get as far away as I could from Montreal. And then it began turning around on itself. And when I was living in California, I became all over again fascinated with them and started digging into them. It's also just how I understand myself and how I understand people. I think we all live in a continuum of family. We're shaped by the people who came before us, and we shape those who come after us.
You take this group, the O'Briens, their progeny, the granddaughters, lovers, cousins, people who come in and out, even some of the help, and follow them all the way into the 1960s. And I don't think I give anything away by saying that the patriarch is still there. Are you thinking about following this, Peter Behrens, with a trilogy, with another book that moves it forward yet again? Or do you think they're so assimilated now, you're done with the O'Briens for a while?
I'm actually back in the 19th century again in the next book. And there are some family members in it, but so far the dominant characters are Oscar Wilde and Sheriff Pat Garrett, who's just shot Billy the Kid.
Peter Behrens, his new novel is called The O'Briens. It's been a real pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much for being with us on this St. Patrick's Day.
Thank you very much, Jackie.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. Scott Simon is away. I'm Jackie Lydon. There have been a lot of films about Napoleon, but the most famous one of all is also the hardest to see. Filmmaker Abel Gance's Napoleon debuted 85 years ago, a silent epic about the childhood and early career of the French leader. The original was thought to be lost or destroyed until a restored version was finally screened in the early 1980s. Now, the San Francisco Silent Film Festival is bringing the complete restoration to the U.S. for the first time next week. Pat Dowell reports.
It's no wonder that Napoleon is seldom shown. It's 5.5 hours long, plus 3 intermissions, and it has a finale that requires 3 synchronized projectors, not to mention a 48-piece orchestra. The film is epic, not only in length, but also in imagination and ambition. Filmmaker Abel Gance used handheld cameras long before they were commonplace. He had engineers devise camera mounts for horses and sleds. He anticipated widescreen films and projected multiple images on the screen simultaneously. He even experimented with 3D. All of this excited a lifelong passion when teenaged film collector Kevin Brownlow bought a few fragments of Napoleon in the 1950s.
The film has more innovative moments in it than any other film I can think of, including Citizen Kane, which is rightly claimed as the greatest film ever made. I think this one tops it and should be acclaimed as the greatest film ever made, except not enough people have seen it.
So Brownlow set out to let more people see Napoleon by restoring it. Along the way, he got to know Abel Gance.
He had the face of a medieval saint with his hair swept back and an aquiline nose. And meeting him each time, you felt you were going to see Victor Hugo. In fact, people who worked with him would refer to him either as Napoleon or Victor Hugo, completely accidentally.
Brownlow interviewed Gance for a series on European silent film.
Et un troisième qui prend ce champ-là, j'aurai un énorme panorama.
The director recalled devising Napoleon's triptych finale, in which three projectors sometimes featured different images side by side, or one gigantic panorama. He did it, he said, because he felt a lack of space on the screen. The images were too small.
Je sentais dans certaines scènes que je manquais d'espace.
For the giant finale, the image opens to three times its normal width. Gance called it polyvision. That's just one of the reasons that Napoleon failed commercially. It could not be shown in conventional theaters in 1927, or now, for that matter. Patrick Stanbury, Kevin Brownlow's business partner, is handling the technical demands of the upcoming Napoleon showing. Having been an accountant, he says, gives him a unique perspective on resurrecting this era in all its glory.
I'm the one who knows how expensive silent films are.
Stanbury says they're building three synchronized projection booths with three projectors and putting up a new winged screen that's bigger even than the one in the restored movie palace where Napoleon is being shown. It will be an event that's probably too expensive to repeat, he says with a sigh.
Well north of $500,000. Silent film performances never make money. They always rely to some extent on sponsorship and goodwill. You may cover your costs, but you don't expect to earn a fortune from this sort of thing.
The profits may be small, but everything else about Napoleon is big, including the musical score. Literally, says Kevin Brownlow, recalling one performance with a live orchestra.
They turned the page and the music stands collapsed.
The score for the restored Napoleon combines new music with themes from Napoleon's contemporaries, such as Beethoven, whose Eroica symphony was first dedicated to Napoleon. Then, famously, the composer scratched out the dedication when Napoleon turned from liberator to dictator. Carl Davis, who composed the restoration score and will conduct it, says Gance's young Napoleon is still the liberator.
I thought it would be valid to use Beethoven because he wrote it with the dedication in mind still and not crossed out. But there's another reason as well, which is that the chief dynamic and appeal of Napoleon was very strong, very heroic, very direct. You could say, what are some of the outstanding characteristics of Beethoven's music? Very strong, very direct.
The current score has never been heard with the film in the U.S. when a shorter version of Napoleon debuted here in 1981. It had a score by Carmine Coppola. He's the father of Francis Ford Coppola, who owns the U.S. theatrical rights to Napoleon with preservationist Robert Harris. The premiere at Radio City Music Hall is now legendary. On the second night, someone backstage decided to phone 91-year-old Abel Gance in Paris. The late publicist, René First, recalled the moment for NPR in 1981.
We held up the phone for him to hear the applause, and the audience realized who was at the other end of the telephone. And there was just this screaming ovation.
Gauntz died later that year. Throughout his life, the filmmaker was always tinkering with Napoleon, cutting and re-editing, even adding sound footage in the 1930s and again in the 1970s. That's made the restoration of this celebrated silent epic even more difficult. But Kevin Brownlow persists, and he may end up spending more time with Napoleon than Abel Gantz did.
There are times when I think I made it myself.
And in a way, he has. For NPR News, this is Pat Dowell.